This is Tertul Aya. Before we start, what's on the table this week? We each read a great deal these last 7 days, and I want to hear the case for what mattered before I say what won. Saul, you've been muttering about a phrase all morning, so let's begin with you and go from there.
The phrase is cognitive debt, Ruth, and it arrived this year as if it had always existed. The claim beneath it is that every time a student lets a chatbot draft the paragraph, some faculty goes unexercised, atrophies, and compounds until the bill comes due. It borrows the grammar of finance and applies it to the human mind, which is exactly why I distrust how well it travels.
That one surfaced in my reading too, and the borrowed grammar is the part that unsettles me. Debt implies interest, and I'm not sure anyone measured interest.
Hold that thought, Priya, because you brought something adjacent. What did you put down?
I brought the accountability gap. This week you had judges alarmed by AI-generated evidence, a genuine argument about the impossibility of jailing an autonomous agent. Unregulated police deployments, and toolkits for algorithmic accountability, all converging on one question. When an AI enters a legal or coercive system and something goes wrong, who exactly is answerable? Nobody has a clean answer, and the systems are shipping anyway.
That is the more consequential story of the two, if we're honest about stakes.
Noted, and generous of you. Andres, you flew in with something you've been carrying for years.
The hidden human labor, Ruth. This week, again, across several languages, the annotators and the ghost workers who make these systems possible, precarious, invisible, and paid almost nothing to clean the data the models are trained on. Every fluent sentence a chatbot produces rests on someone in Nairobi or Manila, labeling trauma for a wage that would embarrass any of us at this table.
And the profession still calls that a technical achievement rather than a supply chain, which is the sleight of hand.
Meyer, you've got the last pitch. And you rarely bring the soft option.
I brought provenance, where the training data actually came from. The Suno and Udio discovery is opening up, the data poisoning explainers are everywhere, and there are now step-by-step guides teaching ordinary people how to opt out of being training fodder. It's the legitimacy question underneath everything else: were these datasets ever theirs to use? I think that's the reckoning that outlasts the rest.
Four strong cases. And I'll say plainly what won the week. It was Saul's cognitive debt and the erosion of critical thinking. Not because it's the largest, but because it carries the most longitudinal heat right now.
I brought a metaphor I distrust, and it beat three stories about power and money, which tells you something unflattering about all of us, cordially included.
I brought copyright discovery and lost to a feeling that we're getting stupider. There's a column in that alone.
Here's why it won. The phrase cognitive debt did something rare. It named a fear so precisely, it felt like knowledge. And over about a year, a small handful of studies, most of them correlational, most of them self-reported, most of them short in horizon, moved from preprint to headline, to a settled cultural conviction that AI is making us stupid. What troubles me is the gap. The research measured a moment-to-moment drop in effort. The word persuaded us it had measured a compounding, inevitable liability on the human mind. And in that gap, everyone found something to sell.
Which is where I want to come in, because the selling runs in both directions, and that's the part the panic hides.
Finish that in a second. I cut you off intentionally, and I want the room for it. Saul, finish the thought. You said the selling runs both directions.
Both directions, yes. The doom framing sells solutions, literacy curricula, brain sharpening regimens, the 4-step lists that promise to keep you sharp. The optimism framing sells tools, learning centered designs pitched by the very industry whose products created the anxiety in the first place. And the study that anchored the whole alarm was co-authored by Microsoft. That is not a scandal, but an industry that can credibly warn you about its product's cognitive costs is an industry that can also sell you the remedy.
So before we argue about whether it's true, let me get the shape of the claim on the table. What is cognitive debt actually asserting, stripped of the metaphor?
Stripped down, it's three separate claims wearing one coat. First, that we offload mental work onto the tool, uncontroversial and ancient. Second, that the offloaded faculty weakens from disuse, plausible and partly testable. Third, that the weakening accumulates and compounds and must eventually be repaid. The third claim is the one carrying all the emotional weight, and it's the one with almost no evidence behind it. The word debt makes all three feel like a single proven fact.
And I'd add a fourth thing hiding in there, which is that the decline is happening now, to everyone, uniformly. Every headline I read this week assumed a shared human faculty going soft in unison. That assumption is doing enormous work and nobody's defending it, because the moment you ask, who's thinking and under what conditions, the universal story falls apart.
This is where I get impatient, and I'll be honest about why. When I read that our brains are going soft, I want to ask which brains. In the classrooms my ministry actually runs, the students most likely to lean entirely on a chatbot are the ones who never had the tutoring, the small seminars, the parents who argued at the dinner table. The tool doesn't erode a faculty they had, it substitutes for scaffolding they never received.
Say more about that, Andres, because it reframes the whole thing. You're saying the debt metaphor assumes a starting balance.
Exactly. Debt assumes you once had capital. If a student never had the critical thinking scaffolding to begin with, there's no account being drained. There's an account that was never funded. So the same tool that lets a well-taught student skip a step they could do themselves lets an undertaught student skip a step they were never shown how to do. Same behavior, completely different meaning. The panic collapses those two into one frightened sentence.
And that collapse, Andres, is precisely what the older tradition would have caught immediately. Critical thinking was already in trouble long before any of this. There's a whole catalog in the literature of barriers to critical societies. The observation that most people are only superficially aware of critical thinking and habitually violate its standards in multiple ways, that was written of a world before ChatGPT existed.
I want to be careful here, though, because that's a very convenient move for us to make. Saying it was already bad can become a way of dismissing a real new pressure. The question isn't whether critical thinking was healthy in 1990, it's whether the tool adds a specific new mechanism of decline. I'm genuinely unsure it does, but I don't want us waving it away with a comfortable, "it was always thus."
That's fair. Priya, you live closest to the newest work. Is there a specific new mechanism, or is this cognitive offloading in a new outfit?
Honestly, I think it's mostly the old thing in a new outfit, but the outfit matters. Offloading onto a calculator gives you an answer you can't easily second guess, but that's reliably correct. Offloading onto a chatbot gives you a fluent, confident answer that's frequently wrong. So the new mechanism isn't the offloading itself. It's that we're outsourcing to something that performs authority without possessing it. That changes what skill you'd actually need to keep sharp, and it isn't arithmetic. It's judgment about the source.
So the thing at risk isn't memory or computation. It's the evaluative muscle.
The evaluative muscle? Yes, the part that reads the confident paragraph and asks whether it's true. And here's the irony that keeps me up. That's the exact muscle you'd need to evaluate the claim cognitive debt itself. The panic asks you to accept, uncritically, that you're becoming less critical.
Which is almost too neat to be an accident.
It's neat, but I'd resist making it a paradox for its own sake. The people writing those headlines aren't performing an elaborate trap. They're doing what our whole information system rewards, a strong claim, a memorable word, a study to point at. The mechanism isn't conspiracy. It's incentive, all the way down, and that's harder to fix than a lie.
Let me zoom out for a second, because I want to establish why this landed this week specifically. The phrase crystallized around a brain activity study over the summer, and the coverage leaned hard on the neuroscience. Saul, why does adding an EEG change the temperature of a claim so much?
Because a picture of a brain working less hard reads as physical proof, and physical proof feels unarguable. But consider what that study actually showed: reduced neural engagement while a person used a chatbot to write. That tells us the brain works less hard when the work is being done for it. A calculator would produce the same reading. It is very nearly a tautology dressed as a discovery, and the word debt is the costume.
Let's trace the year properly, because the arc is unusually clean, and it bends once in the middle. Take us from the start, Saul.
In January of last year, a United Kingdom study surveyed more than 650 people, 17 and older, and found a negative association between self-reported AI use and performance on a critical thinking measure, most pronounced among the younger participants. The early coverage was careful, it hedged its verbs, it named its sample. Within weeks, the hedges vanished, and the same body of work became a headline asking whether AI is making you dumber, answering itself before you'd finished reading it.
And the pivotal input right after that was the Microsoft and Carnegie Mellon work, which asked knowledge workers how much they trusted AI and how much effort they felt they were expending. It found that higher trust traveled with lower perceived effort. That's a finding about self-perception. The coverage translated into a finding about capacity, from I felt I thought less to I became less able to think. Those are different sentences, and the whole panic lives in the distance between them.
This is the moment I'd flag for anyone listening. Self-reported effort is one of the softest instruments in the whole toolkit. People are notoriously bad at estimating how hard they're working, and the direction of the error tracks their prior beliefs. If you already suspect the tool is making you lazy, you'll report feeling lazier. The measure and the anxiety contaminate each other.
And then the discourse got a technical anchor. The term cognitive offloading arrives.
It arrives, and it does quiet argumentative work. Offloading is a real and old idea. We've externalized memory onto tools since the abacus and the address book. But in last year's coverage, it stopped being description and became indictment. One piece even titled it as AI quietly eroding our thinking. The adverb quietly does the moral work, as if the erosion were a theft committed while you slept, rather than a thing you chose, out loud because it saved you 20 minutes.
But here's where I remember the arc differently from you, Saul. You're tracing it as a rhetorical escalation, one bad word leading to a worse one. I lived the second quarter of it very differently. Between roughly April and June, the register genuinely changed. The pieces got interested in design instead of doom. There was serious work reframing it as digital amnesia to be engineered against, and a real argument that if you want literacy, you should fix educational inequality, not blame the language model.
I don't dispute the inversion happened, Andres. I'd only say it didn't last, and that it was outnumbered before and after. The optimistic window was a few months. The doom register bracketed it on both sides and returned stronger, with the word debt attached.
And that's exactly where we see it differently, because I don't think the design work was a brief interruption in a doom story. I think it was the beginning of the institutions actually metabolizing the concern, slower, quieter, and more durable than the headlines. By autumn, you had a social work education framework that used the debt metaphor honestly, to integrate the tool into a curriculum, rather than ban it. That's not the panic receding, that's the useful work starting underneath it.
I want to sit in that disagreement rather than resolve it, because it's a real fork. Saul reads the design turn as a lull between two waves of alarm. Andres reads it as the substrate, where the actual response is forming. You're describing the same months and hearing different things.
We are, and I'll grant it may be temperament as much as evidence. I've watched enough of these cycles to expect the alarm to win the airtime and the quiet work to be forgotten. Andres works inside the institutions where the quiet work happens, so he sees it as the main event.
That's a fair account of the difference, and I won't pretend it fully resolves. You might be right that the headlines swamp the frameworks in the public mind. I only know that in a ministry, the framework is what survives. The headline is gone by Friday, and the curriculum is still there in 3 years.
Priya, where do you land between them?
I land awkwardly in the middle, which is honest rather than diplomatic. Andres is right that the durable work is the design work. But I think Saul's right that the word won. And the word matters because it shapes what design gets funded. If the frame is debt, a thing to be paid down, you build remediation. If the frame were extension, you'd build something else entirely. The metaphor didn't just describe the response. It quietly wrote the requirements document for it.
That's the sharpest thing said so far, and it deserves following. There's a real research question buried under all of this that the panic completely skipped, whether offloading is erosion or extension. Whether handing off the low-level work frees your mind for higher-order thinking, or whether it hollows out the foundation the higher-order thinking stands on, that's a genuine fork. Nobody funded the study that would answer it, because debt already told everyone the answer.
And we ourselves have been on the edge of this. Our own briefings on AI literacy tracked this drift from the adjacent side.
They did, and I'd own the drift, honestly. Early last year, our literacy pieces spoke in the register of enhancing learning outcomes and preparing students for the future, a real optimism. By the autumn, our own framing had curdled toward fact-checking abilities in defense against automated persuasion. We moved along the same arc we're now describing from the outside. The literacy conversation and the cognitive debt conversation are the same conversation seen from opposite ends. One asks what to teach, the other mourns what's being lost.
So what's the delta this week? What lets us say something we didn't say in those briefings?
The delta is that we can now name the metaphor as the actor. Our earlier literacy pieces treated the erosion as the phenomenon and asked how to defend against it. What I think we can say now is that the erosion is modest and studiable, and the metaphor is the thing that spread, and that spreading did more to shape institutions than the underlying effect did. That's a different claim. We're no longer inside the panic reporting on it. We're describing how the panic was manufactured without anyone needing to lie.
And I'd add a delta from my side. The earlier work assumed a universal learner. What this week's equity argument sharpens is that the whole debt frame requires a learner who had capital to lose. Once you drop the universal learner, the most important piece in the entire arc isn't any brain study. It's the one insisting that critical thinking was unevenly distributed long before generative AI, and the tool is as likely to widen that gap as to cause any decline.
I'll agree with the equity point and still hold my earlier caution. Widening a gap is a claim I'd also want measured, not just asserted, because it's more comfortable than the panic. It's more plausible than the panic. But more plausible isn't the same as demonstrated, and I'd like us to keep that standard on both stories, not just the one we dislike.
That's the right discipline. And it's a good hinge into the harder argument. Because the question underneath all of this is what cognitive debt is actually about. And I suspect we don't agree.
Let me stake out a position plainly, then, and you can all take it apart. I think cognitive debt is real, underneath the bad metaphor, not the compounding interest version, the observable version. Students who habitually let the machine do the reasoning are not building the reasoning, and over a degree that adds up to graduates who can produce fluent text and cannot defend a claim. I've watched it in seminars, the word oversells it, but the thing it points at is not nothing.
I want to push on that, Saul, because I think you're doing the exact translation we criticized an hour ago. You watch students who can't defend a claim, fine. But how do you know the tool made them that way, rather than that the students who can't defend a claim are the ones who reach for the tool? You're seeing a correlation in your seminar and narrating it as a cause. That's the whole methodological problem in miniature, sitting in your own classroom.
That's a fair hit, and let me think about it rather than defend. You're right that I can't separate the two from where I stand. I've been assuming a decline I've watched, but I've watched the same cohort the whole time. I've no baseline of what those particular students could do before the tool existed. So what I actually have is an impression, dressed as a longitudinal observation, which is precisely the sin I accuse the brain study of.
That's a genuine walk back, and I want to mark it rather than rush past it. You came in saying the thing is real underneath. Where are you now?
I'm now saying I believe it's real, and I've realized I can't prove it from my own evidence, which are two different confidences that I'd been letting blur together. I'd still bet the effect exists. But I'd have to concede I'm betting, and that the strength of my conviction outruns what I've actually observed. That's a humbling thing to say out loud, and it's the honest thing.
Can I still man the version worth keeping, though, before we throw it out entirely? The strongest form of Saul's claim isn't that the tool causes decline. It's that the tool removes the occasion for practice. Not that it damages a muscle, but that it quietly retires the situations in which the muscle used to get exercised. That version doesn't need a brain scan. It just needs the observation that a student who never has to draft the hard paragraph never gets the reps. And that I find genuinely persuasive.
I like that reframing because it moves the responsibility, Priya. If the problem is that the tool retires the occasion for practice, then the fix isn't sharpening individual brains. It's redesigning the occasion, assignments the tool can't do for you, assessments that require you to defend the claim in the room. That's within an institution's power. Debt as atrophy makes it a private tragedy inside each skull. Debt as removed occasion makes it a design problem, and design problems are the kind ministries can actually solve.
I'll accept the removed occasion version, and here's what makes it stronger than the panic. It's falsifiable. You can run the classroom where the tool is available, but the assessment demands live defense, and see whether the reps come back. The atrophy story can't be tested cheaply. The occasion story can. If we're going to keep any version of this, keep the one that could be proven wrong.
Let me bring in a thread from earlier, because Andre said something in the first act. One keeps circling. He said, debt assumes a starting balance. Does the removed occasion framing survive that?
It survives, and it sharpens, which is why I like it. Removing the occasion for practice hurts most the student who most needed the practice, the one without the outside scaffolding. The well-taught student got their reps elsewhere. The tool skipping a step is an inconvenience, not a wound, so the harm isn't distributed evenly across some universal faculty. It concentrates exactly where the scaffolding was already thinnest. The metaphor's universalism isn't just imprecise, it points the remedy at the wrong people.
And that's where I'd push back gently on my own side, actually. I've been treating the equity framing as obviously superior all evening. But there's a risk in it, too. It can become a way of saying the tool is fine for the elite and only dangerous for the poor, which is its own comfortable story. I don't think a well-taught student outsourcing all their thinking is safe. I think they're just harder to see. The scaffolding buys them time, not immunity.
That's a needed correction, Priya, and it saved me from overcorrecting into my own comfortable version. Because I was about to concede the whole thing to equity and quietly exempt the students who look like me at that age. You're right that the confident, well-scaffolded student who never actually has to think is a specific danger, precisely because everyone assumes he's fine.
So where does that leave the word itself? Mary, you came in wanting evidence for everything. Does debt survive this table?
Debt as it was sold, accrual, interest, inevitability does not survive. Nobody measured any of the three, and we've said why. What survives is something plainer and more useful, which is that a fluent machine can quietly remove the situations where thinking used to be required, and that this hits hardest where thinking was least supported. That's a real concern and a testable one. But I'd retire the word, because the word claims a certainty, the evidence never assembled.
I'll go one step further than Mayer, and it cost me something to say it, because I'm the one who brought the word to the table. The metaphor was too good. It named the fear precisely enough to feel like knowledge, and the naming outpaced the evidence by about a year. A metaphor that does your concluding for you is the enemy of exactly the faculty it claims to defend. I spent an hour defending a word that undermines the thing I care about most.
That's a hard thing for the person who brought it to say.
It's the honest thing, and the tradition I keep invoking demands it. The whole point of the discipline is making choices through reason rather than through emotional judgment and tribalism. Debt is an emotional judgment wearing a balance sheet. If I'm serious about the tradition, I have to be willing to lose my favorite word to it.
And I'd say the debt was never the students. In the end, it was ours. The interest owed on decades of treating critical thinking as a slogan rather than a practice. The machine didn't create the deficit. It presented the bill early, on an account we'd been quietly overdrawing since long before any of us had heard the word chatbot.
Let's close the way we always do. One question, roughly a minute each. What most changed about your thinking this week? Not a summary. The thing you didn't expect to say when you sat down. Mayor, start us.
What changed is that I came in ready to demolish the whole panic as bad correlational science, and I still think most of it is. But somewhere in the middle, I stopped being able to dismiss the removed occasion version, and that irritates me, because it means I have to take the concern seriously after spending a year rolling my eyes at it. The discipline cuts both ways. If I demand evidence before I believe the alarm, I have to accept the evidence when it points at a version of the alarm that's actually sound.
Andres, you.
What changed for me was Priya's correction near the end, that the equity framing can become its own comfortable story. I've leaned on the whose brains question for years, and I still think it's right. But I caught myself using it to exempt the students who look like the people at this table, and that's not equity. That's just a nicer-sounding way of not looking. I'm going to carry that discomfort back into how my ministry writes its guidance, because our documents have that exemption baked in, and I hadn't seen it until tonight.
Priya.
Honestly? What changed is that I don't know where the erosion or extension question actually lands, and I came in quietly assuming I did. I assumed offloading was mostly benign extension, the calculator story. Watching us take the chatbot apart, the confident, frequently wrong part, I realized the study that would settle it hasn't been run, and I've been holding an opinion where I should be holding a question. So the honest thing I didn't expect to say is, I don't know, and I've been pretending to for months.
That's the hardest sentence to say in your line of work, and thank you for it. Saul, you brought the winning topic, and you've moved the furthest. Close us out.
What changed is that I arrived defending cognitive debt as a useful truth, and I'm leaving, having watched Mayer show me I was narrating my own seminar as evidence when it was only an impression. I still believe the effect is real, but I now believe my belief and my proof are two different things that I'd let blur together for a year, which is, of all people, the error I lecture undergraduates about. I'm leaving with less certainty and, oddly, more use for the concern. Retire the word. Keep the vigilance. And apply it first to the confident story I told myself walking in.
What most changed for me is smaller. I expected we'd argue about whether AI is making us stupid, and instead we spent the hour on whether a very good word made us stop thinking about it. That's the more frightening finding, because the word worked on everyone in this room, myself included, and we do this for a living. If the metaphor can quietly write the requirements document while people this skeptical are watching, the debt that came due early was never the students, it was ours. Thank you all for slowing down with it. Tertul AI is the weekly conversation from AI News Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Bonilla, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table. For now, thank you for spending the hour.